This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in Humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Later, we'll break down today's biggest regional stories. But first, we are knee-deep in primary election season, and it's hard not to notice the political winds shift on immigration. In 2024, Republicans leaned hard into an anti-immigrant message, and even Vice President Kamala Harris was talking tough on the border. But fast forward to now, and the script has flipped. Democratic candidates are pushing back against what they call extreme immigration enforcement, while some political pundits warn that immigration could become a liability for Republicans in the midterms. So, what changed? And how do campaign strategists decide which messages will actually move voters? We dug into the politics behind it all. At the table was Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law and Democratic debate strategist, and Diego Morales, who's an organizer with PUNO, that's the Pilsen Rapid Response Network. Jason started things off by explaining how political campaigns decide their messaging on certain issues in the first place.
Well, the initial conversations, if it's going well, Sasha Ann, you have to first ask what you actually believe in. We hope that that's the place where candidates are starting from. Mm-hmm. And then it's a question of knowing what your issue environment is. Some of that's going to come from polling. The basic understanding of where people stand on particular issues for you and where they might stand for your opponent. So part of it will be doing your own self-research and developing and thinking about what your message is going to be based on what you've done in the past and what you're free to be able to say. And then you're going to be thinking about where your opponent is and what you can use to bring contrast against them. Some of that's going to be done, like I say, by polling. Some of it's going to be done by research mm-hmm. about positions that the candidates have taken in the past. And then you go from there.
Yeah. And so are there also constant adjustments being made as you're looking at polling, as you're hearing feedback? How do you factor that in?
Of course. And then you also have to take into account things are dynamic. You're not shooting at a target that's going to be standing still. Particularly, you mentioned debates. You know, in a debate, you've got to understand what the attacks are that are going to be lodged against you ahead of time and then figure out, all right, how do we respond to that particular attack that's been lodged against me, mm-hmm. pivot from it, and then go to ground that's a little bit more favorable. And on this particular issue, that has been a long-standing strategy for Democratic candidates in debates, at least over the last few cycles.
Yeah. Now, I want to hear from you both on this because, as I mentioned, you know, one big takeaway from the 2024 election was Democrats need to be talking about economic issues, right? They seemed just, you know, 50,000 feet above what was actually happening on the ground. And while that's on the lips of many candidates in Illinois, immigration is also at the forefront here in as far as their messaging goes. So were you expecting immigration to kind of come into play here? Diego?
Yeah, I think absolutely you saw many crises. A lot of them have to do with our foreign policy, the things that we're doing in other countries that has caused a lot of unrest, a lot of instability in places where my parents are from in South America, that has led them to try to find a better life in this place, in this country that has prided itself on being a place where people can come and make a better life for themselves. And you saw an influx of folks from Central and South America because we had, for example, placed sanctions on countries like Venezuela, had more aggressive foreign policy in the global Global South in general that brought more people in, and we have a system, an immigration system here that's unfortunately set up to put immigrants in a state of vulnerability and in a state where they can be exploited to be cheap labor for this, for our economy to enjoy, you know, the kinds of foods that we have, to enjoy the service industry that we have, et cetera. It's so much of our economy is run by this class of immigrants that our country relies on to be exploitable, to be undocumented, to be in a state of vulnerability. And this came to a head. And because you're also experiencing things like economic devastation, hyperinflation. I mean, my generation famously is the first generation in a long time that has a worse standard of living than my parents do. Mm-hmm. And that's something felt in blue cities. It's felt in red places. I grew up around a lot of these Republican areas too that are seeing a lot of devastation and immiseration because it's so hard to get by. And instead of having bold solutions where we can say this is the real answer to the problem, you have Republicans that are pointing the finger and blaming immigrants, which makes absolutely no sense on the face of it, right? But then you have, unfortunately, a Democratic Party establishment that has essentially decided to cave to, quote unquote, pivot to the right and feed into those kinds of arguments instead of boldly standing up and defending immigrants and talking about how immigrants are a lifeblood of our nation, and also addressing the economic insecurities that people have directly.
Yeah, relatedly, I mean, Jason, in 2024, Republicans won on economic issues, but also on their stance on immigration. Why was that a winning combo, a winning strategy?
Well, to take a step back, the issue of immigration, unfortunately, notwithstanding everything Diego said, it is all too common that attacks on immigrants pay political dividends. And we're talking going back to the 1850s with the Know Nothing Party, which was founded based on opposition to immigration of Catholic Germans and Catholic Irish. Then in the early 20th century, campaigns against Italian, who would become Italian Americans, but then were Italian immigrants. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing the most recent iteration of it now. And it has been kind of the all-purpose enemy for the Republican Party in the last few cycles. And if you notice, in 2022, 2020, it was the idea of a caravan that was coming up from South America. Then that disappeared. Yes. Now it's taken another form. And it's been used to justify a whole range of conduct, whether it's blowing up boats in the ocean, mm-hmm. or whether it's particular economic policies or particular policies on crime or healthcare.
Always an us versus them lens.
And used as a way to leverage into each of those issues. And what Diego is describing in a lot of areas that he has familiarity with is a politics of grievance. It's a politics of people are not serving me. And so when you can point the finger at somebody else, that is a way to make that issue more resonant. In 2024, the reason that it was so resonant was several fold. First of all, it was visible. So in a lot of cities, you had migrant shelters.
Yeah.
And that made the issue resonant and visual in a way where it was easy enough for those who wanted to exploit it mm-hmm. could do it. You had a candidate who was more than happy to weaponize it and had a history of weaponizing it in the current president, and to do so from a place where he had perceived favorability on it. He was running at about a 9-point advantage over Kamala Harris on that issue. So you put all these things together, and also a perception that President Biden had moved too slowly on issuing executive orders about the border, and Kamala Harris had been perceived as the border czar. When you shake all those things up, you put those things together, someone who's willing to exploit an issue, willing to exploit a people or a group of people, and all those other factors, it made the issue resonant. And again, not just because it's immigration, but because it gives an entree to a whole other set of issues that Republicans want to emphasize and stir up grievance, like on the economy, like on crime,
right.
like on benefits, like health care. The claim is that illegal immigrants are taking health care benefits. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an all-purpose way to press the button on each of those issues, and it was successful.
Yeah, let's stick with 2024 for a second here and end Kamala Harris. This is, you know, a time where President Trump went after her for the millions of border crossings that were happening at the time. He called her, quote, failed, weak, and dangerously liberal. I want to play a little bit of one of her political ads. This is Harris painting her or herself, really, as someone who can be tough on the border.
Kamala Harris has spent decades fighting violent crime. As a border state prosecutor, she took on drug cartels and jailed gang members for smuggling weapons and drugs across the border. As vice president, she backed the toughest border control bill in decades. And as president, she will hire thousands more border agents and crack down on fentanyl and human trafficking. Fixing the border is tough. So is Kamala Harris.
I'm Kamala Harris, and I approve this message.
At the time, Diego, how did you feel about this messaging coming from Harris, being tough on the border?
I just don't understand. If you're running against a Republican Party that is villainizing immigrants, that is trying to blame them and create lies about them, why would you run on being the better Republican? Why wouldn't you run on the other side of that issue and defend immigrants? And instead of talking about increasing border agents, which we have seen, not just now, but this has been going on for decades, border agents, the DHS, this whole apparatus of the state that has impunity, that can surveil American citizens, that can murder people in broad daylight with virtually no consequences. That is not the answer when you see this other side saying, this is more of what we need. We need more agents. We need more crackdown. We need more villainization of immigrants and more blaming them for our real problems. I was just dumbfounded of like, who thinks this is a good strategy when there is a blaring gap on the other side where even, you know, when I grew up, I remember George W. Bush in the early aughts was a Republican who would talk about how immigrants make America great. And it was just really, really sad for me and people in our community to see nobody in the political establishment talk about that or sort of embody that rhetoric and that spirit.
Yeah. These days, Democratic candidates in Illinois, they sound a lot different from what we heard from Harris in 2024. Here are the top three Democratic candidates running for Dick Durbin's Senate seat at the first debate that they took part in January.
We need to dismantle ICE. We need to impeach Kristi Noem, and we need to build an agency that people can trust.
ICE needs to be abolished, and we need to move this country forward and make sure our communities are safe.
Not a single dollar more for ICE or DHS. That's the way I voted last week, and that's the way the Senate should vote. We have to make sure they unmask ICE, wear out an identification, and finally have an inspector general within ICE to make sure they abide by the rules and regulations of the land.
The voices there of Robin Kelly, Juliana Stratton, and Raja Krishnamoorthy. So it didn't work, Jason, back in 2024 for Democrats. What do you make of the shift now?
Well, first, there's one difference in the two contexts there. We had two different elections. The first set of ads were run in a general election by a Democratic candidate in a general. The ones that we just heard were in a Democratic primary. So that alone shifts the terrain in terms of the claims that you ordinarily could make on these issues. But what's really changing the circumstance is that immigration is now, in the minds of the public, ICE. And ICE is immigration. Shelters are gone. ICE is here. And what that has meant, particularly in cities, and particularly in Chicago, is a sense of an occupying force. And you have to meet voters where they are. And that is why, when you look at the polling, and the campaigns, no doubt, were looking at internal polling long before we saw public polling, but most public polling demonstrates that wide majorities in the United States think that the Trump administration has gone, quote, too far. And what that is about is not that immigration and handling illegal immigration is not an issue. What that is a salience of that issue on methods. And those methods, too far, are really tied to ICE. Only about 30% of Americans right now have a favorable view of ICE.
Yeah, 65% of Americans said ICE has gone too far.
And in the public mind, whether that's ICE or whether that's Customs and Border Protection, either way, that's what people are seeing. And why? Because of what they see on their televisions and on social media. It's the salience of images that has really made this a powerful argument that is now shifted the issue debate in a different direction. And if you think about it, where we started, at the beginning, we talked about where this issue was in 2024. It's because immigration can tie into so many values, like security, like the economy, and also asking fundamental questions of politicians of what are your priorities? How can you not deal with an issue that seems to be a common sense issue? And that's why so many Democrats in those races had to establish bona fides on security first.
And I just played clips of you know, political leaders here, but I mean, this is being talked about on all levels, right? It's not just the Juliana Strattons and the Robin Kellys and so forth. So I wonder if there are questions swirling around about like the true motive behind the messaging switch. Everyone's just talking about ICE or being anti-ICE? Is it because that's what they hear on the streets?
Well, it's a combination.
Among voters?
I mean, it's a combination of the kind of activity and organizing that people like Diego have done on mm-hmm. the ground, and then those who have video recorded. We have two killings.
You're seeing
right?
it in full display.
Yeah, you have people being hunted down, and you have people in masks. And I will not underestimate the importance of that politically, because what's the environment we're living in right now? It's the idea of, we don't like people who are in power to be unaccountable. That's what the anti-corruption environment, an anti-elite environment, is about. And so on a gut value level, when people see that, my hypothesis is that cuts to the very core of where people are sitting right now, is very much having antipathy towards that. And put aside the questions of cruelty, decency, all those things. This is a basic question of accountability.
Yeah.
And that is not something that is owned by one particular party, and in fact cuts across political parties, as something people want.
Or it should.
Right now.
It should.
Yeah,
right.
Well, I think it has.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
In your view, Diego, what is just immigration enforcement?
Well, I think that what is it that we as a country see ourselves as the purpose of ourselves? Nobody, the vast majority of our country, of the people in this nation, come from somewhere else, right? We're a nation that was founded by immigrants, that was built by immigrant labor, some of them who found themselves here escaping persecution, some of them who had been stolen from their lands too, to build this country. I think it is, what is just to me is to fulfill that spirit and to say that we are that house on the hill where people can come and build a dignified life, escape persecution, and create this project, which is this large melting pot of cultures and progressing ourselves into the future. Mm-hmm. That said, like, that is why ICE, that is why even DHS, these are fundamentally unjust institutions, because the reality of the policy has been that it has been instituted to create an exploited underclass of immigrants for cheap labor. That is why we have never been able to achieve comprehensive immigration reform, even though rhetorically that's what we hear from even both sides of the aisle, because the reality is that whether you're Democrat, whether you're Republican, there are large corporate donors, large corporate interests who
yeah.
rely on that steady stream of cheap labor coming into this country, so that the person who grows your food, the person who cooks your food and serves it to you, the person who keeps your economy running, who runs your public services, they will be afraid to speak up, to express their rights, to fully embody themselves as full citizens and respected residents of this country.
We hear abolish ICE, abolish Trump's ICE, dismantle ICE. I mean, what would it mean for immigrants in Pilsen if ICE was abolished?
It would mean an opening of a door, of a new chapter to talk about what it really means for us to honor that spirit of immigration. I think about even under, say, Ronald Reagan back in the 80s, we want amnesty for almost 3 million immigrants who have been living here, who have been working here, who have been creating families here. And that is possible in this moment too. And I think this is an issue in which, you know, yes, it's, you can learn a lot about people from polling, but also mm-hmm. politics are something that is made. Politics is something that is made through leadership, right? You have people now, you know, it was abolish ICE during Trump's first term. Now that is the floor. It is
yeah.
not just abolish ICE. What you hear from people is that these are dangerous criminals that not just need to be abolished, they need to be tried, they need to be jailed. This whole system needs to be dismantled and something reasonable needs to replace it. So when people try to walk around with these phrases like Trump's ICE, we have members of our rapid response team whose fathers were deported under Obama, the deporter in chief, who saw kids in cages under Democratic leadership as well. We don't want a Democratic ICE. We don't want a Republican ICE. We want an end to this aggressive, unjust, brutal immigration system, regardless of who is at the helm. And one thing I want to add here is that while the rhetoric shows a shift, and I think that is a positive adjustment, you're also seeing the people, especially on the ground, having to deal with the brunt of this, taking the lead. And I'm thinking of places like Minnesota, who engage in that general strike on the 23rd, who are really mobilizing our communities, mobilizing constituents to bring the fight to the Trump administration, bring the fight really in the material way on the streets. And I think regardless, it's nice to see people shift the rhetoric to mm-hmm. better reflect the direction of the people. But I think much more than that, if folks want to be on board, we need real leadership. We want real material support. Start engaging on these issues and these kinds of tactics where we're actually making a fighting stance instead of this constant defensive pivoting, calibrating to this
right.
political game. I think people are done with that.
Well, real quick, Jason, the State of the Union address from the president comes up tonight. What are you watching for?
Well, I suspect it's, I don't know that I'm watching for anything other than what I imagine that will occur, which is there will be a blizzard of falsehoods. I think that's just honestly what it will be. And I imagine on the subject that we're talking about here today, there will be a doubling down on the nature of why safety and security has been enhanced. So everything we've talked about today has been about the broad operations that ICE is conducting. And the thing that has resonated with people is this is not, quote unquote, the worst of the worst. And the methods that you're using are inappropriate. The people that are getting swept up in it, that's wrong. What we're going to hear tonight on this issue is here's how much safer you are while the radical, lunatic Democrats want you to be unsafe. It's going to go back to that basic framing. I would also expect that the president is going to attack the United States Supreme Court tonight.
Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer in the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law and a Democratic debate strategist, and Diego Morales, who's an organizer with PUNO, the Pilsen Rapid Response Network. Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Now we'll turn to the top stories of the day from the Illinois lawmakers who are attending or boycotting the State of the Union address to local transit news. At the table was Lisa Labas, a WBEZ anchor, Araceli Gomez-Aldana, a WBEZ reporter, and Tina Spondalis, Chicago Sun-Times national political reporter. Lisa, I'll start with you because good news, Chicago snowplows, they now have
big news,
official
Sasha.
Names. Yes, yes.
Big news.
Yeah, tell us who the top winners were
this
year.
All right, so we knew that Abolish ICE was going to be the runaway name for the year.
Yes.
That was the big one. And so that's not a surprise. The others, there was a field of dozens of choices.
Dozens entering this contest.
But the big winners include Stephen Colbert. I believe he lobbied for that on his on the Late
so
Show.
So surprised to hear that.
Which, fine, great. I love it. Also, we've got Pope Frio the 14th, which was delightful,
that's
I think.
Cute.
The Blizzard of Oz, I guess Ozzy Osbourne nod there. Okay. Caleb Chilliams, because why not? And my favorite, Sven Gulli. Are you a Sven Gulli fan?
I found out about Sven Gulli this morning because
what?
That was the one
girl
of the six that I was right. Like, who is that?
Okay, if you grew up in the Chicago area, you might have likely watched Sven Gulli. He does horror shows, a little comedy, little sketches and stuff, and songs. And he's just kind of been an institution around here. And a big fan. My family is a big fan.
Yeah, so knowing that now, I think that this is very clever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're all very good.
Yeah, they're really good.
So I'm really, maybe we should put a bet in it. Let's do a stationwide bet. We'll
for sure. Now, you know, speaking of snow plows and cold weather, Lisa, we just saw New York City get pretty hammered with snow yesterday.
Indeed.
Are we expecting any of that? Please say no.
No. But, you know, that doesn't mean we're not going to get snow. But the New York Times saying this specific nor'easter cyclone bomb that was hit, you know, that hit the East Coast, it's kind of petered out. The final flakes headed into New England during the early morning hours today.
Mm-hmm.
There might be a little lingering snow later on Wednesday and into Wednesday evening in Chicago. We could get a little bit of snow. Otherwise, we've got sunny skies this week. So don't worry. Take heart. But those poor snow plows will have nothing to
They'll
do.
Have nothing to do for a while.
They'll just
have
look
to
pretty.
Sit there and just Chilliams.
Yes.
Caleb Chilliams. Araceli, it's been a few months since Operation Midway Blitz rocked this city with ICE and Border Patrol agents just stopping and detaining and literally taking residents. You had reporting out this week, though, it was looking back at the impact that is still very much being felt today from mm-hmm. that operation. So tell us more about what you learned.
Yeah, I think it was really just, you know, my colleague Mike Wentha and I really went into these neighborhoods like Little Village and Pilsen and Chicago's Southeast Side, to kind of talk to them about what are you feeling now after this all happened? And it took months, Sasha. It was a long, because we really wanted to make sure we talked to a lot of people.
Yes.
And then when you know, I was talking to our editors, Ari Soglin and Alex Keefe, they were like, well, maybe we need to kind of look into, like, how did these neighborhoods even become these targets? And really just kind of went back and looked at, like, the history of Little Village and Pilsen and the East Side, and how did they become these hubs for Latinos and Mexican immigrants. So yeah, it was a lot of reporting. A lot of people are still feeling really, really scared.
I can only imagine. Tell me more about some of the folks that you talked to and just what they said to you about maybe how habits have changed since mm-hmm. those months in the fall.
And I just want to start by just thanking people for talking to us. It's not the easiest thing right now as a reporter to go into some of these communities and say, what's your name and tell me how you're feeling, right? It's kind of a scary thing. So the people that did speak to us, you know, a lot of some business owners in Little Village, I spoke to the owners of Moreno's Liquors, and they're three generations here in Little Village in the Pilsen area.
Yeah.
And they talked about sales just plummeting because there was nobody out. People are scared to come out. And they, you know, a lot of them actually compared it to COVID, except that during COVID there were resources and everybody was on the same boat and we're all helping each other. And this really just kind of affected some neighborhoods harder than others. And they were like, there was no help for us, you know, so it was very tough.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you for that reporting. Another story that I know you're following, Tina, it's that tonight, of course, is that State of the Union, the annual address that the president gives to the nation. Tell us more about what we think Trump's going to talk about.
It's going to be a long speech, is what he's already said. It starts at 8 o'clock. He's not going to stick to the script. It's going to be long.
And by long, what do you think he means? An hour?
Midnight?
Plush?
More than an hour.
Okay.
It's supposed to be called America at 250, Strong, Prosperous, and Respected. That's the theme of tonight's speech. He's going to talk about tariffs. He's going to say the tariffs have been good for the country. He's going to talk about foreign policy, that America should have intervened in mm-hmm. different political situations. He's going to say that he has helped people lower prescription drug costs and the tax cuts from last summer. He's going to say things are great, and he's going to highlight to Americans that he's made things better.
Representatives from Illinois, at least some of them, they're making their feelings known and they're boycotting. So let's start there. Who's not going?
Yes, clearly Democrats do not agree with that perception that he's going to talk about tonight. Senator Tammy Duckworth is kind of the biggest name from Illinois who said she's not going. She said that it's going to be another campaign rally full of lies and that she does not want to sit and listen to it. Then we have Congressman Mike Quigley, Sean Kasten, Delia Ramirez, and Jan Schakowsky, and Eric Sorensen. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 House Democrats from Illinois. Mike Quigley said he's going to a town hall instead. Schakowsky said that she's gotten so many calls into her office that they basically were like, you cannot go to this. We do not want you to go to this. And she's saying that she could not in good conscience sit in the House chamber and listen to him.
Wow. Well, Mary Dixon and I will be catching up with Congresswoman Delia Ramirez next hour. She's joining us on Say More at 10 a.m. So stick around for that conversation. We'll get to hear from the horse's mouth why she's not going. Of the representatives that are going, Tina, they often bring guests, right? And their choice in guest, that also sends a message.
So
who's bringing who?
Senator Dick Durbin is bringing Teresa Lee, and she is a woman who inspired the original DREAM Act back in 2001. So she was a young Chicago woman who was undocumented, who went to Lane Tech High School, like brilliant musician. And so he highlighted her case as in a case of someone who deserved to have a permanent path to citizenship. Her parents came here when she was 2. She is a citizen now. She's in New York. She's a music teacher. So he's kind of paying homage back to 25 years ago as he's set to retire. Wow. That this is one of his crowning, you know, bills, achievements that he really wants to have is to pass the DREAM Act. You also have Raja Krishnamurti bringing a 21-year-old UIC student whose father was held in Broadview for several days. Mm-hmm. You have Robin Kelly bringing the Chicago Urban League CEO Karen Freeman Wilson. And just various, they're trying, as you said, they're trying to highlight healthcare issues, affordability, diversity. And yes, it does signal something who you bring.
Yeah. Araceli, we got a couple of transit stories to share this morning. First up, thousands of drivers in Cook County could be getting refunds. As a driver in Cook County, I'm listening. Go ahead. Go ahead.
We'll see. You know, the Sun-Times is reporting, France Millman is reporting that, you know, really what happened is Circuit Judge William Sullivan, they ruled that the city is liable for overcharges. And we're talking about more than 1 million tickets that were issued by the city from 2012 to 2022. So I'm like thinking, did I get a ticket then?
Likely.
I probably did.
I got to think back did. To 2021 when right? I first got here, right? 2022.
I mean, those snow times.
I was getting acclimated to a new city, exactly. Officer.
Yeah. Well, I think what really we got out of the story is that it was really hard to potentially, you know, go up against a ticket, say it was inaccurate or something happened. Nobody was getting any type of help in that sense. And that's why almost $70 million in overcharges are what we're talking about here, $34 million in interest on those tickets that were issued. And if the ruling stands, the refunds would add up to nearly $104 million.
Wow. And so the city would just start cutting checks?
Actually, I think what's really probably going to happen is, you know, well, the city, the law department issued a statement saying that City Hall is considering filing an appeal.
Oh, okay.
It goes on.
Yeah, I should have expected that. Yeah. As I said, we got more transportation news here, Lisa. Yeah. That helpful parking app that drivers, including myself, use, Spot Hero.
Sure.
Could be under new ownership.
Right. It looks like it's going to be bought by Uber or merged with Uber, but it's going to be its own standalone still company. So Spot Hero based here in Chicago. And, you know, who knows? I don't know if this means anything for prices on parking.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I have no idea. I think that still remains to be seen. But again, it looks like Uber is going to take over Spot Hero.
You use Spot Hero?
You know,
when I
heard this news from Lisa this morning, I thought, oh, that kind of makes sense. You know, like it might be a peanut butter and jelly situation. But again, I don't know. I have problems with both. So we'll see.
I agree. It's very nerve-wracking to me to like have your phone ready for the Spot Hero and there's people behind you.
I know. Yes. No. I know.
No. Where's the QR code?
Scanning that code.
Also just finding some of these garages. I've been in places where I'm like, where
there's
am I
that
going?
Too. You got to pull up the photo, right?
I got a ticket once with a Spot Hero and I had to prove my Spot Hero.
Oh, worst.
Yeah. But yeah, the app taking hassle. Over the other app, I don't know. We'll see. The jury's
until,
out.
Yeah. Until you use it, who knows?
What other stories are you following, Lisa?
Okay, I got some fun news for you, Sasha. Okay. So for the first time in history, a couple of historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, are going to play a baseball game at Wrigley Field.
Ooh.
This sounds like it's going to be a blast. You've got Prairie View A&M and Alabama A&M. They're going to play each other on May 2nd. This is the inaugural Chicago HBCU Classic.
Oh, that is so cool.
Doesn't it sound awesome? So the organizer of this is a group called Black Baseball Media. It says the game is inspired by the longstanding tradition of HBCU football classics. They hope this event draws alumni, families, baseball fans from across the region. I know the Midwest is a huge HBCU hub. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not in the South where all the hubs are, you're here. Yeah. You're up here.
And that sounds
so
cool.
I have a feeling this is going to be a big deal.
May 2nd, you say?
May 2nd at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Big historic. Have fun if you're going. I want to go.
I want to go. I think I'm going to go.
I think like the people watching is what you go for.
Yeah. I love watching baseball games.
The little tribes and the little, like, you know, I'm part of this fraternity. I'm part of the, you know, come on. That's going to be so fun.
HBCU pride is something to watch. It's super fun. Now, another political story that we're watching, Tina, election funding, specifically from super PACs. Now, before you dig into the races that you're watching and what you found out, for the people in the back, what are super PACs? Just so we're on the same page.
They are groups that are not directly aligned to individual campaigns. So they can be for a certain cause, like in Illinois, we're seeing APAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. We're seeing pro-cryptocurrency, pro-AI. So these are people who give money to promote a cause. So in Illinois, you're seeing those three issues super seep into congressional races. So
I see. And PAC, I should be clear, is Political Action Committee.
Yes. That is correct. And, you know, we got 21 more days left of seeing all these commercials every day at all times on TV, on YouTube, digital ads everywhere in the whole world.
So what are you finding out about our folks here in Illinois?
So we have four districts that are being super targeted by super PACs. The 2nd, the 8th, and the 7th. Oh, sorry, 3. And it's really interesting, the 2nd district, that's Robin Kelly's former district because she's running for Senate. You have a pro-cryptocurrency PAC. You have an APAC PAC and an AI PAC, not to be confused with APAC.
My goodness.
But all right.
It's all too really, it sounds super complicated, but it's not. It's like they've chosen people to either support or to run negative ads because they don't want them to win. And State Senator Robert Peters is being super, super attacked.
Yeah, because like other candidates in the races, they're getting very frustrated about this. I remember it even coming up in the debate that we hosted weeks back with the three leading candidates for Dick Durbin's seat. What do they have to say? What's their big gripe with super PAC funding?
They say it's buying a seat.
Yeah.
And we've seen that in Illinois. That's not, you know, not a good look. So they're saying this is an unfair advantage. And also these are, many of these are Trump donors. The people who are funding these PACs are Trump donors. So in a Democratic primary, that should be a toxic thing for many voters. And so these candidates are speaking out to tell voters this is not a normal thing for a Democratic primary.
And it's so hard to get information like that out, to be honest, because people, obviously, we're all busy. We're all trying to figure out who's even on the ballot and all of these. And when you really dig into this, it's a very difficult topic to just talk about when you're waiting at the grocery line or something like that.
Yeah, and then to look up your own donors. There actually are 4 districts. I was correct. It's 2, 8, 9, and 7. Those are the districts in which super PACs are involved in Illinois.
Oh, well, I'm so glad you're keeping track of that that I don't have to. Sports fan Araceli Gomez Aldana is in the building. I mean, tell me what's on the agenda tonight in Chicago sports.
So the Bulls are hosting the Charlotte Hornets tonight, and this is kind of a big name or big game a little bit because they're in a 9-game losing streak. That's right, the Bulls are in a 9-game losing streak. You know, there has been a lot of changes in the roster, people been traded, so it is kind of like hard to get going. But they only have 30 games left, so they really want to break this streak now because people are getting frustrated. And even, you know, Josh Giddey was talking to media, and he sounds really frustrated. He said, you know, it's our job to go out and win, and we're not keeping up. We're not, you know, going to keep using excuses of a new team. It's frustrating. And I'm kind of with him. I'm like, let's get going, guys. We got to get a win here. So
it's pretty disappointing. Yeah.
Well, hopefully they win.
Tis the story in Chicago sports. I'll leave it there. WBEZ's Araceli Gomez Aldana and Lisa Lavez and Tina Spondellis from the Sun-Times.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.